During session, I usually offer a koan commentary as the Dharma talk. And I will do that, but I wanted to frame it somewhat differently this morning, this afternoon, and begin a little bit about how these stories come to us and how we use them. Most of the famous stories that come down to us as koans come from, you know, Tang Dynasty China. Period, we could say, is roughly around 500 to 750, something in there. But the koan collections themselves are compiled much later, around 1000. So there's a big gap between what, if anything, actually happened and the kinds of stories that got written down and how they were used much later. In the West, I mean, you have examples like a teacher like Socrates, who wrote nothing down, but whose life was documented by two different contemporaries, Xenophon and Plato. And the two accounts portray a figure who has who's very different in the different accounts. Xenophon's being a much more plain-spoken and straightforward figure, and Plato's Socrates, through all the dialogues, being engaged in much more elaborate philosophical discourse. And it seems pretty clear that Plato starts out doing something like recording the sayings of his teacher, but pretty quickly starts using his teacher as a mouthpiece for his own ideas, and creates dialogues with Socrates as a character that are not entirely, but substantially his own invention. And I think that we see something like that happening in many of the koan stories, probably most famously with the sixth patriarch in the Platform Sutra, which was, if you look at some of the work of somebody like Alan Cole in Fathering Your Father, Hui Neng was not made up out of whole cloth. He was a much more obscure or minor figure that a subsequent generation needed to fill in a lineage gap, and decided to attribute all these teachings to as a way to establish the legitimacy of one of his ancestors. The other way I was thinking about some of these stories had to do with the movies. I was thinking of first Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Because, in fact, there was a real Butch Cassidy, you know, who may have lived something like 100 years before the movie was made. The big difference was that he didn't look anything like Paul Newman, and he didn't have William Goldman writing snappy dialogue for him. And the other one that I thought about, the Zen context, were the Godfather movies. Because Godfather was portraying you know, supposed mafia world happenings, you know, not that long ago in the past compared to when the movie was, certainly not 100 years ago like Butch Cassidy. But the thing was, contemporary mobsters themselves became really big fans of the movie. And the real mobsters started imitating the characters in The Godfather. They, you know, you start adopting Marlon Brando-like gravitas, you know, and you this is what a mobster becomes. They watch the movie and they learn how to do it, right? And that in particular made me think that there were a number of, you know, American Zen teachers who I could imagine have watched one too many Zen master movies. You know, you sort of get the whole image of what they're supposed to be, and you do the act. Huh? So I think that there was a great kind of circular or reflexive kind of feedback loop in a lot of these stories and in a lot of subsequent Zen history. In this literary period of the Song Dynasty, when the koan collections were put together, people created really snappy dialogue for these old ancestors. And they created an image of what student-teacher relationships were supposed to sound like, and pretty soon students and teachers started doing it, you know? I mean, they became a model for what we were trying to look like. Now, I wanted to go back to the very first patriarch and his stories, Bodhidharma, and say something about what it looks like the storyteller was trying to teach, but how we would maybe reframe that encounter, and what else would we do with it? Seeing as how they made it up, so we might as well have our hand at it as well. See, the most famous story of Bodhidharma starts with his encounter with the Emperor Wu, who was a historical figure. Apparently got a hold of the throne like many other people in those days by killing every other person who was perhaps entitled to the throne, taking it over and keeping it the way he got it. But that having schemed to murder his way to the emperorship, he got religion and became a great patron of Buddhism. And whether this was to atone for all the killing he had to do to get there or not, he became somebody who endowed many temples. This seems to be a matter of independent historical record, not just something we get from the koan stories. But in the koan record, when Bodhidharma comes to see the emperor himself starts off by saying how he's been such a patron of Buddhism and asking what merit this has accumulated. Merit being a very commonplace idea in Buddhism, that one cleanses one's past karma through good deeds, right? Through the patronage of monks and priests. And Bodhidharma famously pours cold water all over that and says, no merit whatsoever. Now, this does not seem to register very well with the emperor, And if Bodhidharma is famous for something, it's not for skillful means. He doesn't do anything to make it easier or more accessible to his student to grasp what he's talking about. Instead, Bodhidharma is sort of the archetype of the absolute impenetrable nature of the truth that offers you no easy entry point, no handhold, right? It's just this kind of absolute presentation of emptiness. So the emperor doesn't get it, as most of us wouldn't. And so if we were trying to engage the emperor now, we might really want to try to probe a little bit about why he asks about merit, right? Is it because he's got a bad conscience of who he had to kill to get to the throne? Is he is it a matter of dissociation? Does he want to forget about his past and just identify as a good and beneficent ruler? He wants that. That's how he wants to be seen and remembered. I think now, whenever we think of our own practice, or when we're working with a student, we have to ask, what are the core ideas or stories they're telling about what practice is and what's it for? And so the emperor comes with this story about merit, and so if we're going to do him any good, we have to start deconstructing something about the idea of merit and why we would want to accumulate it. Next, the emperor tries to say, well, if there's no merit, what then is holy? What is your holy, what is the holy truth that you teach? And Bodhidharma replies, just vast emptiness, and there's nothing holy about it. So he keeps pulling away any notion of holy or merit or anything like that that the emperor thinks is the essence of what religion is, right? That's not exactly an unusual idea, that religion's going to get you in touch with the holy or the godly or the transcendent. Bodhidharma instead offers him only emptiness without any holiness, devoid of holiness. Again, this seems to do the emperor no good. He doesn't understand it. What could we say that might make this more relevant? See, I think nowadays people come, I would say, almost with the opposite problem or the opposite question. And it's they're more inclined to have a kind of existential despair about things. And the student will come and says, everything just seems empty. What's the point? What's of any value? And now we have to find an answer that's sort of the opposite of that, something along the lines of everything is holy, right? Not this kind of everything's empty and meaningless or devoid of holiness, but not so fast. Everything just as it is is sparkling, special, and worth your attention and care, right? That's sort of the reverse lesson that a modern Bodhidharma has to offer contemporary emperor, right? Nowadays, people all too easily treat everything as if nothing is holy, nothing is sacred. How about turning it around? Everything is sacred, everything is holy. Finally, Emperor says, "Who are you telling me all this?" Bodhidharma says, "I don't know." Again, "I don't know" is like emptiness, supposed to penetrate to the absolute depth or essence of true nature. No self, no one home, right? Again, a fairly unskillful answer as far as the emperor is concerned. He doesn't get the point at all. I might say instead to him, "You and I, we're both treated like very special people. You and the emperor and in your robes, and me, the Zen master, in my robes. But you know, when we take off these robes, we're both just human beings." Right? Maybe he could hear that. Yeah? Instead of saying, "I don't know, maybe there's something," what would it be to try to present, "Nobody special"? You know, how about it, Emperor? Can you relate to the part of you that's not special, right? Or are you just a robe, right? Are you just a suit, right? Who are you under all that, right? Now, Bodhidharma, you know, at the end of all this, he's shown out the door. And the emperor has left pretty much the way he started. One can imagine that as perhaps a grain of historical truth, one day a monk named Bodhidharma had an interview with the emperor, hoping for some patronage, and it did not go well. But he decided to rewrite the story, so instead of a failed job interview, he turned it around to make it into the emperor just was too dumb to see the truth. Right? It's the way the guy who writes the story can turn things around. Right? Bodhidharma comes to us as this totally uncompromising figure of the absolute, of wall gazing, not offering anything for us to get a grip on. And in all the pictures of him, you know, you get all these pictures of him scowling, you know, this really, you know, fierce looking character. But you know, he became such a caricature that all those portraits sort of all, you know, eventually sort of take on a rather comic aspect, right? It's like people realize that as an archetype, it's very exaggerated, and that you probably don't want to have a teacher who, you know, in order to get his attention, you have to cut off your arm, right? The dilemma is that, like it or not, we tend to incorporate these images of that kind of absolute fierceness with what we expect of teachers or expect of ourselves. It becomes a kind of historical justification for a kind of authoritarianism or even a kind of brutality in the treatment of monks, where the harsher the teacher, the more authentic. The more authentic the training, the more difficult it is, right? And if people nowadays don't cut off their arm to impress the teacher, I'm told it actually became a ritual in Japan that if somebody was, parents would not let them enter the monastery, they would cut off a finger and present it to them as a sign of their sincerity. I remember there being a nun in the San Francisco Zen Center who led the sewing, the robe sewing classes, who was missing a digit of a finger for that reason. There's a certain way in which figures like Bodhidharma are cartoons or fairy tales that we that are intended as archetypes, but we take them almost literally, and they become part of our sort of Zen superego of what we think we should be doing if we're the real thing. It's a strange idea that it's sort of like comparing yourself to a character in Marvel Comics, right, as a model of what a superhero is supposed to be. There's certainly a way in which we have to grasp what he meant by emptiness, what he meant by I don't know. But we have to do it from the perspective of our own humanness. We can't use practice to escape that and turn us into a cartoon figure, even a spiritual cartoon figure.